Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 551. I'm in San Diego. I'm at Comic-Con. I'm looking out my window and just seeing scores of humans. Scores can be the only word to describe how many people are wrapped around the convention center right now. I'm doing a bunch of panels. I'll have to do the Walking Dead panel in about an hour and a half, but then we're doing Nerdist Podcast Live. There's a handful of tickets left for our 7:30 show at the Balboa Theater. If you go to Ticketmaster, you can get tickets for that. Michael Rooker and Evangeline Lilly are guests on that. And Nerdist has a bunch of other panels running around Comic-Con. We have the main Nerdist panel is at the Indigo Ballroom on Saturday, the 26th, at 2 p.m., about 2:30 p.m. In the Indigo Ballroom. And then, there's a podcast panel. So Jonah's going to be on it, Matt, Sandra Doherty, Akron Blacker, Janet Varney, Gil from The Mutant Season, Dave Ross. It's Saturday, 1:45 at the Horton Theater. So go ahead and go see Nerdist people talk about things. I'm so excited. I got in kind of late yesterday, so I haven't been to the floor yet. I haven't been to the convention center, so just getting all geared up. Okay, breathe. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, Loot Crate. So Loot Crate is basically a monthly subscription box service. If you love kind of nerdy, geeky pop culture gear, then you spend less than $20 a month. You're going to get 6 to 8 items, and that includes licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items, and more, stuff you can't get anywhere else. It's like a friend who knows what you like every month, and then they surprise you with awesome presents. Presents are fun, you know? I mean, and these, you're going to get, the value is way going to exceed the monthly subscription rate, and you have until the 19th of each month at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe to receive that month's crate. And when the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. It's done. It's dead to you. So you'll have to wait till the next month. Make sure to head over to lootcrate.com/nerdist and enter the promo code Nerdist to save 10% off any new subscription. Loot Crate. It's like year long Santa Claus. I feel like Loot Crate needs some sort of a mythological being to deliver the stuff. I don't mean mythological. I mean, yes, Santa really exists. You know what we don't see at Comic-Con? Christmas cosplay. I think I'm going to bring that back next year. Super Mario Santa? What kind of mashups? What kind of mashups can we do? Adventure Time? Claws? I don't know. Loot Crate, thanks for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, which is Eli Roth, who was a phenomenal guest. I didn't know him that. You know, I worked with Eli's brother, Gabe, at G4, and then also on Shipmates. Don't look that show up, whatever you do, please. He's a super cool guy, and he is promoting the new season of Hemlock Grove, which is on Netflix now, and also the Green Inferno game, which is the official game based on the new movie The Green Inferno, which is coming out in September. It's available on Apple and Google Play. And here we go, Nerdist Podcast number 551 with Eli Roth.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's funny just to think about how there was a time where you could just flat out lie to people and they had no way of checking
or proving it. Yeah. No, the Arbuckle story fascinated me. I was like, I was wanting to write something about it because like he hated being called fatty.
Of course, you know, who like, would love that? Why,
but like he and Buster Keaton used to do crazy pranks. Like Arbuckle is an amazing acrobat. So he like there's one story they would go to hotels and like Arbuckle would hold Buster Keaton. Like Buster Keaton would do a handstand on Arbuckle's hands, like put paint on his shoes and walk, and then like walk up the ceiling, and then like do footprints on the ceiling. And then they would watch the maids just be completely confused. This is the 20s, so it was like what the. And then there was one guy that was a like there was one studio head at Paramount at one of the studios that they used to torture. Like the fad in the 20s was having an amazing imported lawn. So they dressed up as like the lawn people, and they went to his house with Vans, and like they rolled up his lawn and went and took it away. So he came home, and like his whole house was like just dirt,
just to fuck with people,
just to fuck with them, because they were the biggest. They were the biggest movie stars in the world, so they could do that kind of stuff. It was like when Jerry Lewis used to run around Paramount, and like he would cut off people's ties. He'd walk and be like, "Hey, how are you?" and then cut off their tie, and they'd go, "What?" and then he would send them a new tie the next day. Like that was,
that was I'm like, a piece of shit.
No, but this kills in France.
No, but Arbuckle and Keaton. There was one night where, like, where Keaton, they had, like, there was something where there was, like, some dinner party that Arbuckle or Keaton was having, like, one of them, and, like, for everyone at the studio, and they were, like, they had invited Buster Keaton to come to dinner, but Keaton dressed up as a server at the party, and he kept coming out and, like, spilling his food on Arbuckle, and Arbuckle, like, picked him up and, like, would throw him back in the kitchen. He's like, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, sir." And then, like, he would come over and, like, be serving the food, and then he would trip and spill it over Arbuckle, like, all over his tuxedo. Arbuckle's like, "How dare you?" And when they do some, like, comedic punch, and, like, he would tumble back into the kitchen, like, "I'm so sorry," until he finally, like, picked up Keaton and physically threw him in the house, and then Keaton like went around and changed and came in a tuxedo, was like, "I'm so sorry, I'm late, what did I miss?" And everyone at the party was like, "Oh my god, there was a server who was terrible." Like, that was it. And then, but back then in LA, they used to go to San Francisco to have like crazy parties, and it was actually Will Hayes who started the Hayes Code and all the censorship, like you have to have one leg on the floor. Like, oh, wow. Before Will Hayes, anything pre-Hayes Code, movies were a lot racier. And then people started saying, "Oh, it's outrageous what Hollywood's doing." And Will Hayes, like, he wanted to be Attorney General of the United States. Like, he was not mayor of San Francisco, but he was someone in politics in California. And so he implemented the Hayes Code. But what he did in the 20s was all these actors were going up to L.A. All these L.A. actors, like, their weekend getaway was San Francisco. So they would go up there and have, like, crazy opium parties. Just go nuts. And so Arbuckle went to one of these parties, and they invited this woman. Somehow he got invited to a huge party that was being thrown by this woman named Maude Delmont. And she was like the Heidi Fleiss of her day. Like Maude Delmont.
A very sexy name back then, by the way.
Maude was the hot name. Maude Delmont was basically a pimp. And so she would bring in young starlets and fix them up with producers that wanted to be famous. So she had a lot of young starlets, but also a lot of prostitutes. And there was a woman, a starlet, this girl named Virginia Rapp, that was 26 years old. And she came to the party, and she had had an abortion that day. Like an
that
illegal
day in the 20s.
In the 20s, she
which had some surprise, some kind of hand crank
had, and it was actually Arbuckle's party, and she was one of the girls, and she was drinking and partying whatever, and she started to bleed out. So they put her in the bathtub, and then they like brought the ice, and basically they called it. They were like, Maude Delmont, like the woman had had an illegal abortion, so it was all the records were destroyed. Like there was like the doctors were like, "No, we didn't give this girl an abortion. When you talk, because it was illegal," and basically, all of that part was covered up. So Will, like I think he was the prosecuting attorney in San Francisco, was like, "We're going to make an example of Arbuckle," and he was acquitted. They put him on trial for a year, and Buster Keaton was the only person who testified in his defense.
Now, did Buster Keaton come in as like one of the inmates, and they did a bit?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. He came in.
But like, how could you arrest these
but
guys?
But basically, well, Arbuckle came from a really broken home and had a violent temper, and his dad was an alcoholic and used to beat him. And he just went into like a crazy, crazy depression for a year as they tried to nail him. And they put Maude Delmont, like basically the star witness, saying that it was Maude Delmont. And they're basically, she was a pimp and a drug dealer and was hiring.
So did this Hayes guy, did he basically like have leverage on Maude Delmont and said, "You know, you need to say these things or else"?
Well, I don't know if it was leverage he must have had leverage on her, because basically we're going to make an example. We're stopping Hollywood from ruining the morality of San Francisco. They can do all that stuff in Hollywood, but they can't come here to do it. But it's amazing that Hayes lost that trial. It ruined Arbuckle's career. He was completely depressed. He never worked again. He drank himself to death, completely depressed. But Hayes went on to impose that morality, like, to the world. Like, the Hayes Code, he got passed through, and suddenly if you only could kiss on screen if you were married. You had to fade out if it was a sex scene. If one person was on the bed, you could never have two people on a bed.
Yeah,
you always
beds.
Had to have one foot on the ground at all times. Like, if you look at It Happened One Night, like, it's a post Hayes Code movie, and if you look at the movies that were just a year or two before it, they were way racier.
Yeah, there was one director, I can't remember who or what movie it was, but they
to get around that. He wanted to show the intimacy between two people, so he had him having a phone conversation, and then he did a split screen, so they're both on their own beds, but like they kind of are above the beds on two different shots, and they're right next to each other, and their hands are pretty much touching.
It's so crazy. It's so it is sort of funny that when you're young, you think of like, oh, the old days, you couldn't get away with anything. It's like, no. They were shooting stag films.
Yeah.
And it was still like there was still stuff, but yeah, it just this one guy. And then what's an interesting connection, well, it is sort of a loose connection, but so I did House of a Thousand Corpses.
I remember that very well.
Right. So we did that movie, and then you know, we made the movie, and then as we were kind of getting to the end of it, Universal said, "Hey Rob, we love the movie. Here's more money to like make it crazier." So the ending of Corpses doesn't look like the rest of the film because he had all this money to make the ending, and it was super violent and super fucked up, and it was at a time when it's like, oh, you know, like horror films weren't gritty enough.
They weren't. Everything was PG-13.
Everything was
I was doing Cabin Fever, which released 2 months after. But Rob and I were shooting almost at the exact same time. It was the same idea.
So then what happens is I think that must have been around maybe Columbine, maybe? There was, I think...
It was after Columbine.
There was some sort of a shooting, and there was something really horrible. And so basically this council of studio heads went to Washington, and they were like, there's too much violence in film. And so Corpses, which had been like high on their list, basically got kind of pushed to the side.
It's amazing. You know, yeah, it was. I think it was Columbine because Bolingbrook. It was one of those things. If that's how the studios are going to demonstrate, it's almost like they sacrificed the horror movie to protect the rest of the violence and all the.
And then
action.
It wasn't until Hostel. Hostel was the movie that then kind of came back and was like, no, horror films are going to be super fucking violent. And then
unapologetic.
And they just sort of needed that little bit of political kiss ass time to pass. So that's sort of a loose connection to the morality clause of violent morality.
Well, of course, I mean, that was one of the things that fascinated me about the Hays Code of what is socially acceptable at the time of movies. And I remember, but you can also feel it's really base. It's all bullshit. It's all grandstanding. Cause it's not about what's socially acceptable. It's really about what are audiences still willing to pay and go see movies about. And, you know, I remember after the Virginia Tech shooting in April 2007, they were like, "Fool, Hostel 2." I was like, "Excuse me?" They're like, "Virginia Tech." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" Like, you're talking about like a horrible tragedy of like a mentally disturbed person who like he did it because of the news. Like, he loved the Columbine kids. He wanted to be like them. And that kid, that was like an immigrant who just watched, like, how does this have anything to do with anything? And they're like, "Well, nobody wants to see horror movies." I was like, "You're just making that up." They're like, "We're going to open you against Pirates of the Caribbean 3 or 4 or whatever it was, Shrek 4. I was like, "You're putting me out on June 8th? Like, why wouldn't you wait until, you know, October when people want, like, why open our movie at the beginning of summer when it's like grim and violence and gore?" And they're like, "No, that's going to be the best release date for it." Oof. And then, of course, they were like, "See, nobody wants to go see horror movies." I was like, "Nobody wants to see horror movies maybe in the first weekend of summer in June when you're opening against Shrek 4 and Johnny Depp. Like, what are you talking about? How does that have anything?" And then they throw up their hands and they go, "Virginia Tech." I was like, "This is, I don't even know what to say. This is completely nuts."
Well, the whole thing about is it's always like, well, we have to pass blame on things publicly to then look like we're doing something for people. And it was all, you know, and ultimately.
And nobody wants to ban guns or look at the gun laws or any of that stuff. No. Like, God
forbid.
Or like
you said, the news, which is the most violent fucking show on television.
Yeah, it's true. Exactly. Or by the way, you know what? You hear more, like, look at the thousands of years of killing specifically because of religion. If you look at the witch trials that all happened for 250 years.
The Crusades.
Where 300,000 people were killed because the Bible said, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." And they're like, "Well, the Bible says we have to kill witches, and therefore you know," and things like anthrax, where a cow's udders would bleed, you couldn't explain because they didn't understand what anthrax was. They're like, "Oh, Goody Sherman bewitched my cow. Let's burn her and take her property. Oh, it's convenient because we also get the property of every single person we kill.
Oh, shit.
So this works out really well for us."
I'm just glad that I finally got an explanation for my cow's bloody teeth.
Exactly.
Yeah. I didn't know.
But you never, no one was ever like, "Well, we got to ban the Bible," because people know it's someone misusing it. So people go, "No, it's not the Bible's fault. It's people misinterpreting it or using it for whatever they want."
Well, people want to blame something
external rather than take responsibility.
In a world where some things have no explanation. But then also to sort of gain political power, and I don't mean specifically politics, but but political in the sense of like, you know, power, like hierarchies of power. So it could be film or any industry of like, this is the thing and I'm going to take it, you know, Joseph McCarthy
But the idea is like film's been around for 100 years and the idea that violence has been around for 100 years is insane. It's something in human nature and human DNA. When people have a conflict, they solve it violently. That's what we're programmed to do. So the, like that's how animals behave. That's how humans behave. When people think they can get away, when people feel like they're on the side of right, they'll do anything. Mm-hmm. If they feel there's no ramifications, they'll do anything. If they think they can get away with it, they'll do it. So that's what scares me. But it's always amazing when these, you know, politicians grandstand as if they really care, but they're also the ones voting to send people off to war and for gun laws and everything, which is it's completely nuts.
Did you do a thing on the was it the Discovery Channel?
Yeah,
about the Milgram experiments.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was terrifying. We recreated the Milgram experiments since the 50th year anniversary. Now, obviously, Stanley Milgram was a scientist, for anyone who doesn't know, in 1962, Yale University, 27 years old, creates this experiment to see if people would shock another person. So people were brought in off the street.
And this is to try to explain, like, the Nazis. I thought I was following orders.
Exactly. Yeah. How could the Nazis have happened? I was only following orders. People think that it was something genetic or something evil or something political, but he was just showing that any average person would shock someone to death. So they're pushing switches where there's a recording. They're brought into a room and they meet a man and he's like, hi, he's like, you will be the tester, you will be the testee, you'll be receiving the shocks. Don't worry, they won't hurt. And they put the other guy in the room. So this person is left and there's like a very, the way Milgram did it brilliantly, he put him behind him, he put him in a uniform, in a medical thing. So we rebuilt the room exactly to the exact specifications with a group of people that have done this experiment before. So people came in to the identical experiment in 1962. Now, obviously, it was not in Connecticut. There were different variables, and he did thousands of people, and we did 30. But the results were identical. It was amazing. 62% of the people would shock someone to death if they felt there were no repercussions. And what was so terrifying was you watch them, and they flip a switch, and they hear the guy go, oh, stop, please, stop. I don't want to do this. I want the experiment. And they look back at the guy, and they go, what do I do? He goes, please continue the experiment. It's like, and the guy goes, no, but he's screaming there. The guy's really hurt. He goes, he won't be hurt. Please continue the experiment. And then they're like, and they ask him a question. The guy gets it wrong, and they just flip the switch. They go, ah! And then, like, after a certain voltage, the guy stops responding. And he's like, and he asks him a question. Is it red, green, or yellow? Okay. All right, because he like reads the questions, the guy answers them. It's like, and then they keep switching it even after they don't hear anything. Oh. So we stopped the experiment, and we'd come out, and then the guy's brought out, and you watch the person. What was so amazing that I really didn't anticipate was you ask the people, why would you? And we asked them, you know, pop up with the cameras, go, why would you shock someone if you knew they were getting hurt? And they'd say, one guy was like, well, that guy told me to. He said that he wasn't going to get hurt. I thought he wasn't getting hurt. I'm a good person. And then another guy who just was flipping the switches like it was nothing goes, well, you saw me. I didn't want to flip the switch. I said, I'm not going to do it. I was trying to help him. Like, oh, I never wanted to flip the switch. Oh, I hesitated there, and I didn't do it until that guy yelled at me and said, you have to do it. And I thought this is a big experiment.
Oh, God.
And it was amazing how people completely rewrite history to suit their own morality. So they felt better about themselves. But there was one guy, they actually left it on the cutting room floor because the guy's breakdown was so severe. He's like, when he realized he was capable of doing it, like he came to a realization going, I could do this to someone. I would have killed someone. And I didn't think, I think I'm a good person. I'd never hurt anybody, but I do. And then one woman, we asked her, like, why would you shock them to death? And she's like, if I didn't listen to my father, he beat me. We're like, oh, okay.
Oh.
And she goes, I grew up, respect. I was taught you don't question authority. That if someone tells you to do something, you go, okay. And that was authority for me. And I learned that if I questioned my father would beat me. And so you're like, it has nothing to do with whether she's talking. It's completely about people's relationships to authority.
So what the experiment ultimately determined was that the Nazis were okay.
Nazis were great. They were only following orders.
The Germans were okay.
Says Donnie Donowitz, the bear Jew.
I
work out at a gym on La Brea.
Yes.
Your poster is up there. Right, I see it. It's right near the pull-up bar. I see it. Three times a week.
That's terrifying.
There you are up there. They got the fucking baseball bat behind your neck. Yeah. Did you work out there or something?
Yeah, I did train there. I trained there and at Crunch way back when. I remember I had to put on 40 pounds of muscle for that.
Oh, shit.
I just went crazy. I was like, Quentin told me not to because I don't think he wanted me to look that good on camera. I might do a couple of pull-ups here and there. And then he showed up. He's like, what the fuck happened to you? And, you know, that was the idea, was that nobody was going to look like, you know, Transformers or like a superhero. It wasn't a Marvel movie. It wasn't like Avengers. It's literally like your Hebrew school class going on a killing spree. And so that's why Quentin was actually mad that I bulked up for the role. But I knew, I was like, fuck, man, I'm going to be next to Brad Pitt. Like, I better fucking bring it. I got to, like, at least, you know, I can't embarrass myself too badly when you're like next to the best looking guy in the world. Like, I gotta look cool.
Yeah, but you're also next to Sam Levine and Paul Rudd, so you're
Well, the best was Quentin. I remember the first day in the lineup, like Sam Levine was there next to me, and he's like, dude, I fucking hooked you up, all right. He's like, look at these guys. He's like, I was like, yeah, it's kind of Bear Jew and the Seven Cubs. These guys are short. He's like, I cast you with the shortest motherfuckers I could find. You look like a fucking superhero. You fucking owe me. I was like, okay.
So, do you like acting? Do you like going like, hey, I don't have to be in control right now?
I mean, I do love it when it's a situation like that. Like, you know, obviously I know you're a horror movie fan, so you're doing House of a Thousand Corpses, and there you are, like, covered in blood.
It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's the best when you're, like, covered and getting your skull drilled in. But it was amazing. You're working with Rob and in that awesome environment. When you're working with friends, like Alex Aja, who did Piranha 3D, asked me to do a cameo, and that kind of stuff, I love it. And if my friend, I made a movie called Aftershock that I wrote with my friend Nicolas Lopez in Chile, and he directed it, and we wrote it and produced it. And it was a really, really fun time. But honestly, I love directing. And for me to give up, I feel like I've like fought so hard to get to the director's chair that to give that up for acting, it's got to be something fucking awesome.
It would have to be Quentin Tarantino saying, do you want to be in this movie?
It's going to be Quentin Tarantino going, do you want to be in a movie with Brad Pitt?
Like, right. Yeah, that's right.
As opposed to what I call you and I go, hey, do you want to be in my student film? It pays nothing, and it shoots for 8 weeks. Yeah. And I just need you for 12 hours a day.
But we have an in at Funny or Die. We think we can get it up.
Can you bring your own wardrobe? No, and cool. Can you make sandwiches?
Obviously, like, I love all aspects. Writing, producing, directing. Like, it all started because in 7th grade, all we would do is like, hey, I think I figured out a way to chop someone's head off. And we'd be like, okay, let's get the video camera. And we'd do a scene of like, you know, fucking shovel whacking or chainsaw. Whatever it was, we were sitting there trying to think of, I would sit there and literally try to think of different deaths I could pull off, and shooting with your friends, and sometimes you're in it and sometimes you're directing. Yeah. And I kind of always knew where to place the, I'd like a sense of where I wanted to place the camera. But it's really fun when I'm acting, but I don't want to, I feel like the best use of my energy really is writing and directing.
So is it, when I watched Rob direct Corpses made me realize that I did not want to be a director just because of the, I mean, I've said this before on the podcast a bunch, but you're ultimately the last word for pretty much everything. Like, you're the guy that has to have all the answers.
Yeah.
No matter what's going on. And I can't remember who was on that said that they would just answer things. Like, because you can't really seem like, I don't know, you just got to fucking answer. So they just learn to like, well, just say something. If it doesn't work, then try something else, you know?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I didn't realize, you know, I went to film school and I studied and watched movies and did my shot list, and I bought the laser disc of Taxi Driver so I could listen to the audit criteria and commentary. I listened to every commentary. I had my 30 different sided CAV discs of Brazil so I could listen to Terry Gilliam in the 160-minute cut. You get up 40, you get like more exercise getting up and flipping the laser disc, you know, than at the gym. And I thought I knew what I was doing, and I realized that the three summers I spent from age 16, 17, 18 as a day camp counselor at Meadowbrook Day Camp dealing with a group of 35, 10 and 11 year old boys was the single best training I had for being
a director. Oh, wow. Yeah.
I had no idea that my skills as a babysitter earning extra cash around the neighborhood, that was actually what directing was. I couldn't have anticipated that. Huh. It's all like, look, at camp counselor, you're like, look, I know he got two cookies. I know he got an extra cookie, but look, I'm going to give you a cookie, and it's a secret cookie, and you got to promise, like, you're going to come through for me on this one.
That's how you have to deal with actors. Like, you have to promise some secret cookies.
I know he's sitting in your chair, but like, I'm going to let you sit in my chair, and that's the way cooler. You don't want to sit in that chair anyways. This chair over here is the cool chair, but it's got to be like our little secret, and you do this favor for me. Okay. Yeah, cool. So you're like the cool chair guy, right? You don't care about that.
That's
chair.
Nice to hear that's your directing style, because I think I'd be like, because fuck you, that's why. He gets another cookie and you should shut up. You should shut up about it.
Guess how well that works.
That doesn't work well at all.
Fuck you.
No, you're right.
They're like, but actors do shit. Like, I was amazed how actors could be really good friends. And then I saw on one set, like a girl was like giving the wrong off-camera lines to fuck up the other one on camera. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, she's like, I'm so sorry. I was like, no, the line is this. And she goes, that's what I said. And I was like, no, you said this. And like the other girl who was on camera was like, she's prompting me wrong to add an extra the or a and, like fucking up my deliveries, fucking up my punchline. She has a line in her head and she can't deliver it the way, because she's now got to fix the line to match the question that was asked. And the other girl's like, no, that's what I said. And I was like, oh my God, I realized. And then she comes, she's like, she's fucking me up because she wants me to be worse than her. And she was right. I watched the dailies and I could see it. Then you turn the camera on and the girl was off camera, got the lines perfectly. But whenever she was off camera, she would screw them up. And I realized she was fucking with you. So suddenly now you have to police that. And I would just yell, like, say it again. So, like, my direction and take was, like, do it again. Until I walked over with, like, the lines. Until I, like, sent her home and I read the off-camera stuff. Because, like, you're thinking, like, this is directing. This is exactly what it is. It's not about the framing or the shots or the mise-en-scene or the environment. It's taking a very insecure person and stopping them from completely fucking ruining your movie. And actors, as a bunch on the whole, are very insecure, and you have to deal with them in a very like respectful way, and you got to make them feel comfortable, and you got to be like, you look good, and everyone's going to look good, and don't worry, I know. But you put them, they outposition each other like they're playing chess. Like you, it's almost like you turn around and they've reshuffled wherever you stage
them.
That's
so crazy, because I know. I mean, I understand the concept of insecurity, and I understand. I mean, like, I'm insecure about stuff, but I've never been, like, aggressively insecure, and as in, like, my insecurity is more like, are you sure that was okay? Because I can't tell.
No.
As opposed to, like, I'm going to snooker someone out.
But you also, like, create your own thing. Like, you're someone with a lot of ideas and a lot of interests and a lot of different... But it's true. Like, you're not, like... Oh my! But you're not thinking like, if I don't look good in this scene, this is my audition for this movie, and if I don't get more here, then I'm not going to get cast. And they operate from a place of fear.
I would fucking hate just being an actor. Like only doing that to me sounds so fucking terrifying.
It's horrible. That's why they're all nuts. But lovely people, but nuts. No, but who is it? It's Christoph Waltz who was saying there are no small parts. There are only small actors, and that any actor, if you look at Christopher Walken in Pulp Fiction, or you look at. You know, the way Michael Fassbender comes in Inglourious Basterds, it's not until chapter 4 and suddenly you're like, whoa, with the fucking movie, this guy just took over the movie. Because he's so good, he's so focused, he's so intense. It doesn't matter if he has one line in a scene, he's in it. And you can see where other actors are. I've had it too, like in every movie, there's someone that they do this thing where when they talk, they will step in front of another actor.
That fucking sucks.
Because they know the focus puller has to pull the focus to them. It's called pulling focus. The actors will pull focus. And I go, you got to keep back. And they go, yeah, but they try to get, they go, yeah, but naturally, if I was talking, I would take a step towards them.
If I was trying to get the camera to focus on me, I'd get in front of it.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
That's what I'm doing live, man.
Exactly. That's what they say. They're like, yeah, but I would, or they do the other thing where an actor will, when another actor is on camera, off camera, they stick their hand in their face, or they grab them and put their head in their shoulder, so as if like you're now subservient to me, like the way dogs mount each other.
Oh my God.
There, and the crazy thing is, having been an actor in Bastards and sort of watching it, I'd see it from the makeup chair on, where I was in the makeup chair and there'd be like someone who's like, but why are you taking so much time? You're fine. You're a guy. You just need dirt or your hair. Like, well, I was like, okay, like Jesus. I get it. I'm not like trying to get extra makeup time, but it starts with that level of, if I don't have my time in the chair, I'm not going to look pretty. If I'm not look pretty, Quentin's not going to put the camera on me because he's going to be mad. But like, it's all, or then the shots don't look pretty. I'm not going to get that modeling campaign. Like, it's that level of nuts.
It's
and it doesn't fucking matter.
Some they type of horror.
horrifying. Yeah,
some narcissistic person with borderline personality disorder just read The Art of War.
Yeah.
They're like, I have to apply these.
I just
read the 48 Laws of Power, and I need to.
It is that. And it just goes through every level of, to the point where, because I noticed it on Cabin Fever, my first movie, I'm watching it, and I was like, why is this one actor? It'd be a wide shot. I've set up a beautiful fucking wide shot with all five characters. And this one actor was like talking on his cell phone and fucking up the take. Or he would twitch and fiddle, like moving his hands, scratching his ears. He'd be like another actor talking, like fidgeting with like a child that's in a car that you tell your child to sit still. And the kid's like picking up things and rattling and making noise. And you're like, stop it. Just stop for a second. And I go, now I can't do that. Fuck it. Okay, just put the camera. And the other actor's like, don't do it, don't do it. And I'm like, why? They're like, he wants you to film him in single. And I was like, motherfucker. Because what happened was he fucked up the wide takes, and I was like, God damn it. All right, well, we got the wides, but let's just get this one shot, because I didn't have his line. I was like, I need this line, and let's just put the camera on him. And he was brilliant. Ugh. Something came out of him and was like, wow, where the fuck was that guy in the wide shot? And I realized he would only, anytime there was another actor in the frame, he would torpedo the scene, so you had to film him in single, so he, as a result, would get more close.
Do you think he knew that he was doing? Crazy. Do you think he was doing that consciously, or do you think it was just...
Everything is conscious. I don't know if it's so ingrained in him, in his subconscious, but the actors are so aware of it. There's no way he was doing that by accident. Because I would sit there with my editor afterwards, when you're looking at it 2 months later, and the editor was like, this guy's the worst actor, and we cut him, and he's like, no, he's actually great. If we got over our anger at him and cut him in close-up, it's like, well, yeah, the movie works.
Oh, wow.
And everyone's like, I remember the other actors watching the movie, and he did his thing in close-up and got a huge laugh, and they're like, you fucker. He fucked us. We were so cool.
It's
you
even kind of worse
that
he was good, because you're like, fuck.
Yeah. It's the worst, yeah. And then, like, it was great. One of the newspapers, like the New York Times or something, said he was amazing, and they were like, God damn it, he was a fucking ass.
You don't even know.
But do you know what the worst? But the thing is, actors like that, their reputations catch up with them so fast that they can get away with that one or two movies, and then unless they're a big star, like obviously big stars can do whatever they want. But actors that are just starting out, like other directors, because on the next person, this is how short they see such short term ball. They don't think the next director that casts them, if they're not a big name, they're going to call me and go, "How were they? How was he? How was she?"
Don't shoot him wide.
And I'm going to go, okay, but just, you want to cast them? This is what you're in for. And sometimes they'll go, I can handle that. Or other time they're like, fuck, forget it. And I'm like, you know, they're like, it's between him and one other person who is. And if someone else has a great reputation, if someone's a lesser actor with a very good reputation, I'll take the lesser actor.
Well, that's why when you see people continually pop up in things and they haven't, that's not like, you know, they haven't really hit it, but they work a lot. I think you kind of start to, you can assume, like, they're probably really cool.
User-friendly.
Because people just want to, they come in and do their job, and they're like, they're nice, also, and they go home.
But it's also what you realize is that there's so much money being spent. I mean, look, Cabin Fever was $1.5 million, but at the time, that was, like, more money than I'd ever amassed for anything in my life. It was, people put up their houses for the money. It was financed by private people. It was independent. It was a lot of fucking money. And one person can actually sink the ship. If someone is fucking it up, like, you have time for one or two takes. You're on an indie, low budget, independent movie. Once you're 3 or 4 days into shooting, you've gone beyond the point of fireability. Like, you can't fire anyone now because you can't go, you don't have the money to go. If it's day one, you can fire someone, and that you can save. But they wait until about day six, and that's when they like turn into a pumpkin and you see who they really are, because they know, that's when the actors know they fucking got you by the balls, because you do not have the money to fire them. And that's when they start getting problematic. Jeez. Or they start out savvy, or they're just divas,
just,
or they're
like
dicks.
To be nice.
And it's all I want. I'm just like, what? But why am I the bad guy? You were going to work at the Gap folding clothes, and I'm giving you money to be funny. Why are you hassling?
Well,
it's because, all their insecurities.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same things that make performers good. Like the downsides of, like, the negative sides of that also are, you know, it's like sometimes you'll see someone really brilliant and you find out they're super crazy and you go, you know, I don't think I'd want to be that brilliant if I had to be,
if
that,
you had to be that crazy. Yeah. No,
to
it's
go
true.
Along to go along with it.
I don't think you need that level of both, because, like, with, I would say, Brad Pitt in Inglourious Basterds, he was really trying to do, like, a just had a very, like, amazing take on the character with the chin and the knife and the gestures. Like, he was so dialed in. and he had just had twins and the like circus of the paparazzi. You'd never know. He was there. He was happy to work. He was nice. He was cool. And I kept thinking, like, is this an act? Like, when's this guy going to snap? And it just never happened. Like, he was just so happy to be there and giving his all and like talking to everybody, like friendly. Like, there was not, literally not a negative thing. And I was like, you know what? Fuck everybody. You don't have, like, that guy's like, you look at Gypsy, you look at Floyd, you look at all the different characters. Like, that guy's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
And he's just nice and easy, and there's no problems. There's no, like, nothing that we saw. And so when I see the people, it's interesting because the director of Cannibal Holocaust, Roger Deodato, I gave him a cameo in Hostel 2, and we were talking about problematic actors. And he said something amazing that it's like, I think of this all the time. He's like, big star, no problem. Beginner actor, no problem.
Mid-range.
He goes, middle actor that thinks they're a big actor is most problem, fucking pain your ass, ruin your fucking
because they
life.
Have enough notoriety that they feel a little power hungry, but they're not insecure. So they got to kind of peacock a little bit.
Yeah. All the time. And everything's about insecurity and what number are they on the call sheet. And but you know, it's weird. I just directed a film with Keanu Reeves, and it was my first time directing like a big major
star.
Knock
Knock?
Knock Knock. Yeah, we just wrapped. I'm editing now. The fucking coolest guy. Like, that guy, and you think about it, like, that guy's been famous since the 80s. Like, that guy's been famous since I was in high school. Like, I remember I was in high school when Bill and Ted's came out. And it was like, that guy has been famous for so long in so many decades. And we talk about the Nancy Myers movie, Something's Gotta Give, or is the doctor, or obviously making Neo jokes, or anything. Like, he, you know, we took Point Break nonstop, like, making Point Break references. He was just so cool, so happy to be. And everyone had said, Keanu's great, you're going to love him. And like, we were shooting Nights, and it was very intense. It's a thrill. It's not a horror movie, but it's like he goes through like insane stuff in the movie. To the point where one night I completely blew his voice out. I felt really, really bad, but he was just giving it his all. So happy to be. He was like, whoa. Oh, by the way, all the time. I was like, dude, you are a, like, I remember, like, the day we were rehearsing, and I looked, and I was like, where's Keanu? And he was, like, lying on the grass, like, face down, like, with a cigarette in his mouth. And I was like, you are a fucking walking meme generator. Do you even know what a meme generator you are? And he, like kind of laughs, and has, like, a sip of his Coke, and a cigarette.
He's, like, 52 years old now or something, right?
He's and he's in fucking awesome shape. Like, his skin, like, he looks amazing. He was so funny. No,
he does
like
have nice
like you
skin.
Sit there.
He has nice skin, okay?
No, he's very nice skin. And, like, because you can shoot him in close-up. Someone who doesn't, because you can't film him. But, like, you look at him like, fuck, man, we should all look that good when we're that age. Like,
you know,
and you go, that's why this guy has been in it for so long. He's seen everything. He has been the biggest, he's still one of the biggest movie stars in the world, but he's had that moment where he was, like, it in the biggest franchise. Yeah. And he just fucking wants to work, and he's great. And you're like, that's all you can hope for.
I was at a party probably 10 years ago, and he was, I never forget this, because he was sitting on a chair, like, outside, just kind of sitting there, hanging out. Seemed totally normal. And then I remember, like, just some random girl walked up to him, and I didn't get the sense that they were together, but she just walked up and got in his lap and just started making out with him. And he just went with it. I was like, how does that life work?
The best.
He just kind of seemed like, yeah, whatever. You know, like, I'll just sort of, that's a hard thing.
I bet that happens to Alex Winter, too.
All the time.
Yeah, all the time.
All the time. Well, he's still buddies with Alex Winter.
Yeah, that's really
like,
cool.
It's great. They're like, you know, they're going to do, they're talking about Bill and Ted's 3. It's like, it's funny. He's really, really funny. And we joke all the time. Like, all the time we would just tease him about sad Keanu. Or, are you sad Keanu?
And he's aware of it, right?
Oh, we fully. But, like, the best was showing him iPhones and Instagrams and stuff. Like, he's kind of disconnected. Like, he's sort of, we're like, Neo doesn't know how to use the freaking iPhone.
Well, I feel like he did an AMA, and I think he wrote, okay, guys, here you go, whoa. And then I think he typed whoa for everyone.
Oh, no, he does it. Like, we would, you know, we were joking. In the movie, he plays an architect, and we sat there for probably 2 hours trying to go through the script to think of a conceivable way that he could scream his profession. So it's like in all the great, I was like, I need to be on the highlight reel of Keanu Reeves screaming like, I am an FBI agent, I'm a lawyer, that's what I do, I'm a lawyer, I win. And we're like, so we just like, I am an architect, like all the time right before. He was so fucking funny. Like, we're like, God, we got it. He's like, oh man, I gotta do that. We got it. He's like, it's right, I do scream my profession and all those movies. And then like all the, whatever. It was the first time we've ever cast him as a dad. So it was the first time he's ever had kids in a movie, and they were like aliens. And like the first day I cast we were shooting in Chile, but I found, it's supposed to be Los Angeles, and I found these two American Jewish kids, so like a girl and a boy, that were so funny. And they like, they made me macaroons. It was Passover. It was so fun. Like, I loved it. They were great. And they would just fuck with him. And they'd be like, look at your hair. Who are you? My mom said you're famous. I've never heard of you. Jesus. What do you look like? Like, can you dodge a bullet? Like, they were sitting on his lap. And he's like, he would look at me going, what the fuck do I do with these things? It's like, dude. And I was like, you're on your own, man. And like, I threw like a puppy in. So he's sitting there with, like, he has like a puppy in one hand and like an 8-year-old more. And he looks at me like, you motherfucker. Like, how am I supposed to, like, and then in one take, the girl was like, no, you don't say that line. No, you sit over here. He's like, no, I fucking got it. All right. Like, it's in the dailies. And the girl's like, I got, like, we were laughing so hard. Like, the first day I was like, you gotta say fudging, Keanu. Can't swear around the kiddies.
What
fuck. Oh, he did that, man. Like, the first day he's like, oh fuck. Then he was like, but he was great. He really, it took him 2 seconds and he was super into it.
I think my favorite Keanu Reeves performance, Parenthood.
Oh yeah,
that scene
with Martha. Was it
Martha Plimpton? Martha Plimpton. But there's that one scene. I mean, he's basically playing Ted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but then there's that one scene where he kind of opens up to Diane Weiss and he's like, you know, I used to wake up every day with a guy flicking cigarettes at my face. And he's like, you know, you need a license for hunting. You need a license to fish. You need a license to drive a car, but they'll let any asshole be a dad. Like, it's this really great scene. And then he kind of steps out and he's like,
yeah.
It was such a fucking great, he was so good in that
movie. He's a really good actor. And what I can see is, like, he's great. Like, he has it. He has the range. I mean, Knock Knock, I wanted to show like a real range with him. But it's just loosening him up, getting him to laugh. And he was great. He's one of those guys that, you know, speaking of troublesome actors, where you see a guy, they're like, how is it that Keanu Reeves, Brad, these people are just the easiest people to work with. They love it. They're so happy to be there. They give you everything. They want it to be great. They're nice to everybody. Like, even in restaurants, like, Keanu Reeves in Chile, it was like nuts. It was like the Beatles. They couldn't believe Neo was there. And he took photos with every single person.
Oh, wow.
In any restaurant setting, he was just like, it's just easy. He's like, well, you know, that's really cool.
Some people are wired that way, and some people appreciate, I mean, it's, you know, I think some people do it because they enjoyed the process and they liked the craft of it, and other people just want to fill a hole that they have in them.
Yes.
But all the external stuff doesn't fill the hole. And then they get more and more frustrated because they're like, why is this ever-widening hole not being filled with fame and riches? And then they get crazy.
No, it's weird. Hollywood, because I grew up in Boston, so my friends are like, dude, what's it like out there in fucking Hollywood? The fuck, dude? And I'm like, well, guys.
you talk funny. Mm-hmm. What happened?
I tell them, like, Hollywood is like the continuation of high school. It's almost like the studio heads are like the principals, like the quarterbacks are like the movie stars. Young actors, you know, they're like the movie stars are like the quarterbacks, like the popular jocks, and like the new girls, like the hot young actresses, yes, are like the hot freshmen that just sort of leapfrog right to the popular crowd. Yeah. And like writers are like the goalies and like utility players on teams that like aren't first choice to hang out with the stars, but stars sort of know they need them to win. So they're like allowed to go to parties, but like the directors are like the cool guys that are friends with the jocks. They're not the top athletes, but they have cool cars. So they'll be like, they get like popularity by association. Mm-hmm. And like the freshman girls know that like the jock is friend, that guy with the car is friends with that jock. So it's like okay to be seen with them, like the directors. But it's like a whole class system. It's the exact same fucking behavior as high school.
I like the studio heads as the principal. Market research has dictated that we're going to have our gratin potatoes.
Exactly.
Because everything's so, what are you going to say?
I think comedians are the AV club kids, I guess.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. For sure the comedians are the AV. They kind of, they're like, we're better. We don't want to be part of that. Yeah. We're better than that.
We got our own thing going on.
Everyone knows we don't want to be part of that.
Yeah.
It's just,
so we have our own hierarchy.
You hear what I said? We just want to make sure that you know that we don't want to be part of
that. I just want you guys to know we don't care because none of this matters in 4 years.
Yeah.
Nothing
matters.
You know what's going to matter? This Buster Keaton movie I'm showing right now. Steamboat Bill Jr.
And then Benny and June. I don't know why I just thought of...
Jeremiah Chechik.
Well, it was the Johnny Depp as Buster Keaton.
Yeah, Johnny Depp, yeah.
That's right.
Someone, I can't remember if that movie holds up or not yet, but someone was like, what's Benny and June? And I said, I remember watching it in the 90s, but I can't remember. At the time, I was like, oh yeah, I think this is a good movie, but I can't remember if I actually thought it was a good movie or if it was just Johnny Depp and Mary Stuart Masterson pretending to have mental problems.
I can't. Yeah, I don't remember anything about Benny and June.
I just remember he's dancing with the rolls on the forks, and yeah. he's reading the art of. He's reading about Buster Keaton.
There was a '90s period of where I have to admit that I bailed on Johnny Depp. I was like, should I? I remember like $11.
Get the fuck out of this room.
Like $11. Like I was the biggest Depp supporter. Like not from Jumpsuit, but right from Cry Baby and Edward Scissorhands. Like great. I thought it was cool that he only Nightmare worked with Tim Burton. Then I was like, do I really want to see Dead Man?
Right.
And then someone's like, hey, I got a copy of The Brave. I was like, they're really, like, wow. I was like, I'm kind of giving up.
Where are you in the Depp train now? Are you back in the Depp train?
Oh, now I appreciate it. But at the time, when you're like, you know, right out of college, like $10 is a lot of money to spend on a movie. So yeah. like, you have to spend subway fare to get there. Yeah. So that really was it. Like, it was like, do I want to use all the money that I've saved up? Is this the movie? You could kind of pick one movie a weekend. Or you go into, like, Starship Troopers and then just movie hop into I Know What You Did Last Summer. And then, like, see, like, 17 different movies. And, like,
I love Starship Troopers, too.
I saw twice that day. I remember we're back for the 10 o'clock. I was like, let's go see this movie again. But I remember now I can't movie hop anymore. That's the only downside to, like, sort of being known as a director is the people, the ushers, are like, wait, are you actually skipping? Paying $10.
Yeah, but can't you just play money? Just let me do it. I just want to do it.
No, this is my process. Like, can't you be arty about it in some way that they would allow?
Yeah, that works really well.
Okay, I'll cast you in something.
I chop people's heads off. This is my process.
Hey, man.
And you know what you do? You just do this to their face. Like, just do that one. Square hand. We're like, okay.
Are you going to put me in a movie?
You're going to be in a movie?
Maybe I will if I get to hop into this other...
That's cool. Can you let me into How to Train Dragon 2 for free, dude?
$20 is $20, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all fucking... So what is it? Just kind of going back to something you said earlier, right?
Because they're... I have the comedy. I know that, like, there are comedy equivalents of the Fassbender, someone who, you know, and for me, it was, you know, it was like Kristen Wiig or Will Ferrell, just like someone, no matter where they are on the screen, you just immediately go, meh.
Yep.
And they without literally pulling focus, just pull focus because of some quality about them. Yep. What do you think that kind of magnetic quality
that
is?
X factor, that it's hard to explain, but there are some actors that have it and you just... And there's the actors that are pains in the ass, and then people warn you, this person's going to be a fucking nightmare, and you're like, I don't care, because when you, it's really someone that's interesting that makes you go, what are they going to do next? And I think that more than being good looking or being funny, they have all of that, but there is, like, I remember Giuseppe Andrews, who's not a big star at all, like, he was in Cabin Fever, he played Deputy Winston, and he just, the way, yeah, man, like, he had a look in his eye, he had something about him, he'd been in Detroit Rock City, the people come out of the movie, and they're like, that guy, like, I love that guy. And I remember there was something with Caleb Landry Jones, when we were making The Last Exorcism. They were like, this kid came in. He'd been on Friday Night Lights. But there was just something about Caleb that no matter what he did in any scene, it was a subtle glance. You couldn't take your eyes off him. And after the screenings, people were like, we love Ashley Bell. We love it. But, like, who was that kid who played the brother? And he played Banshee in X-Men. Like, he's great. Like, but there are those people that just have that thing about them that no matter what they do, they're, like, absolutely hypnotic on screen. And then... the same goes for other people that no matter how beautiful or interesting, like, they're just fucking boring. Yeah. And you just are like, get me. Like, I can't stand watching this person. It's not that I hate their face or anything. I just could give a fuck about what they're going to say next. I just don't care.
Yeah, I think probably some of it must have to do with people who are just net. I think we gravitate toward people who just seem comfortable with themselves in a situation because, you know, I think... just as a species, when someone else seems to have answers that you don't have, you're just like, what do they know that I don't know?
Exactly.
They must know. They seem like they know something.
And they also do, like, obviously the comics do a way of, like, putting the audience just identifies them and puts themselves, like, I get embarrassed like that person. They sort of get humiliated for us.
Right.
And they do the awkward thing that it's like, oh, that's what I would do. I'm too embarrassed to admit it, but I'm that nervous and stupid. I don't really actually know what that thing is either, and I would completely pretend to, and I get drunk on airplanes or whatever they... whatever they do. But no, that's like, no, it's true. Like, you're watching them and you can oddly identify with that, like, embarrassing, like, horribly humiliating situation where you just spiral. Yeah. But yeah, there's some actors that just, like, it was weird because I just rewatched Tropic Thunder, which I loved when I saw it. And I was like, this is a movie. Like, why isn't this in the Anchorman? Why isn't this in, like, the Blazing Saddles pantheon?
I think,
like,
it was too inside.
Like, I think that, but I don't know. I mean, I know it was a big hit, but, like, that movie is a fucking masterpiece. And Robert Downey Jr. in that film, I was like, it's inexplicable. I was like, if he never does anything else in his career, he will have given us that performance.
I can tell you, it's just the single greatest thing. I saw Tropic Thunder twice. I saw it in Los Angeles and I saw it in Memphis and I went to visit my family. And the experience of seeing that movie in those two different audiences was like polar opposites. Because in LA, people picked up on all the jokes about the tropes of action films and actors and like just they got all of the stuff that Ben was doing. And in Memphis, I watched the audience. They laughed in completely different places and didn't seem to grasp like what the overall intended tone and kind of message of the movie was.
People genuinely, generally, I've found, could give a shit about movies about movie stars. Like, they really don't. Like, you know, if it's funny people, like, people are just like, why would I want to?
I think
how can
is
I think
one of the best
like,
comedies of the last 20 years.
Yeah. That was amazing. It was just so good. But that's one of those examples where you're like, he's just fucking hypnotic. You can't, and how did he know that? How did you know he was going to be that brilliant in that? It's just so good.
He is, I mean, I love, he's just a guy I just love. I don't love that he went through what he went through. I feel bad.
Of course.
You know, that he had, you know, like addiction is a fucking, is not a thing that you would wish upon anyone, but. But I mean, what a pull
the
out of a
phoenix has rose out of the ashes, reborn.
When John Favreau was on, I was like, I mean, people just think of Iron Man as like, oh, Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man. It's like, yeah, he was unemployable before that movie. Like,
he's waking up in like, strangers' houses.
Yeah, exactly.
It's insane.
And he just totally. And I remember when, I mean, he's a guy actually that whenever he was in a movie, like when he was in Back to School. And I fucking loved him in that movie.
Yep.
He just always had...
Weird Science.
Weird Science. He just always had a slightly... A take that on something that I just never saw coming.
I know. Do you know what I've... I don't know if you noticed this. Like, I obviously love directors. I'm a director for... I fucking hate director's cuts of comedies. It's like... Really? I think that director's cuts of comedies are the most boring. Like, it's almost like they think... Like, if there's a horror movie and stuff's been cut out, I'll watch the director's cut, see the extra gore, or sometimes, like, Apocalypse Now, I'll watch it. But a lot of the times, I've yet to find an example. Like no one ever thought, oh, wow, that joke's so funny, it needs to be longer. You know? Yeah. Like, when you watch a comedy, and it's tight and funny, and you're laughing the whole time, I like watching the additional scenes that were cut. But when I'm watching the director's cut of a comedy, I'm always inevitably like, why don't they have the version of the theatrical?
I have a theory on this.
It's just too long. It's too slow. It doesn't make it funnier.
My theory on this from a joke writing standpoint is that the jokes that make me, that I write that make me laugh the most, rarely ever work. And I think the reason is because they're too inside my own head.
Yep.
And the rest of the world and audience lacks the context of what's in my head.
Of course.
And so I find... That just like we use it, like, and the audience, the live audience will sort of tell you, like, too long, you know, like, so you sort of get, yep. they help you edit, but in your own head, certain things are funnier because you just, I think it might be the same thing in their head. It's like, oh no, but this is funnier because of all this context that you don't have that's in my head.
I've talked to a lot of people that were like, I can't. Like, they get mad at iTunes because they're like, I can't watch it. Like, because all my favorite comedies, they only have the unrated director's cut. Thinking that people, oh, there's more gross out. There's more...
More is better.
And it just fucking bores me to tears. And you watch and you're like, it's kind of long. It's not as funny as I thought. And then, you go back to the theatrical cut of the comedy, and it's always seems to work better.
There's a couple...
And, like, prove me wrong. I mean, I've made a study of this.
Well, I mean, it's not a flat-out comedy, but the director's cut of That Thing You Do is, a way better movie, where it has a lot more jokes, everything takes its time a little better, and it makes it everything...
But that was more of a drama. I mean, that was it was a comedy, but it was done as
Kingpin
period.
The director's cut of Kingpin.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah,
is it way better? Is it better?
There's like little things throughout it that you didn't. Yeah, that are just fantastic. Like,
okay,
more. You know, some of them aren't just like some of them are just added scenes that like kind of like nail the characters that much better. So when everything gets paid off a lot better when you're watching.
Interesting.
The rest of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's good to know.
Can we just for a quick sec give a shout out to your brother Gabe?
Yes, you guys work together on Shipmates.
Not only do we work together on Shipmates, we worked together on Boat Date.
At sea with my brother Gabe.
I never went on any of the cruises.
Yeah.
You know, because it was I don't know why I'm laughing about this. September 11th happened right in the middle of our production.
Mm-hmm.
So the terrorists won. Because they're Shipmates. So I was just too afraid to travel at the time. And I didn't, they were still sending out, going like making cruises during that. During
that scary time to fight, yeah.
It was a very time.
I was about to shoot Cabin Fever, and people were like, "Oh, there's going to be an anthrax attack."
Every day in New York at that time, there was some, and that's where we did the show. And so I never wanted to travel, so I just didn't go on any of the cruises. But you know, what Gabe had said about the cruise, he was like, you know, you didn't really, it's better you that you that didn't. Much. Yeah. But then uh-huh. he, but
it's
then
like a traveling toilet.
We also worked together at G4.
Yeah, that's right.
And I feel like I just saw him on this lot like a month ago.
Yeah, he's been cutting stuff, producing stuff for National Geographic.
Yeah.
Show from there. But, yes.
So shout out to Gabe Roth, who I always enjoyed working with. Are you, what are you, so you just finished Knock Knock.
And Hemlock Grove.
Hemlock Grove.
We're so excited. Now that was a different, like that was a completely different experience working with Netflix. They're amazing. And it's really, I remember 2 years ago when we went out with the book, Brian McGreevy's novel, and we went out with a pitch of what the TV show would be. And we started meeting with networks, and Netflix actually came to me because they said, well, we have a show with David Fincher, and we have one with Jenji Cohen, and we'd like one with you. And I'm like, well, the little old me and just David and Jenji.
Am I being lumped in with these hacks again?
Oh, sorry. Oh, soil my reputation if you must, but I shall. And they basically said, you know, we can do a show with no commercial breaks, with all the violence you want, and we can do it, tell the story at almost like a 13-hour movie and just drop it all at once, and we'll do it in all of our Netflix territories. So we said, why not? Like, let's do it. Obviously, if it's good enough for David Fincher, good enough for me. and people were saying, well, what is it? Like, so you're doing a web series? And I was like, no, it's going to be on your, like, high-def TV. It'll look, it's like a real show. It's going to look big, expensive, like Game of Thrones.
I don't know, Hollywood.
Yeah, and so it wound up working great. It was amazing, like to just drop it on the public and everybody watches it, and people loved it, and wound up being a huge, huge hit for them. And so we got a second season, and we wanted to make it better and tighter, and so we tightened the second season to 10 episodes. But in the first season, we did like a really insane wolf transformation, and because we're kind of airing all the episodes at once. You know, you're shooting an entire episode in 8 days. So, like, a transformation.
Jesus!
It's hard. Like, if you need a big piece of a scene, you can kind of get it when you're shooting episode 7. Like, okay, let's get the wolf's eyeball falls out. But I wanted, like, a wolf bursting out of someone, and then they eat their own skin and eat the placenta after. And it really, really make it sick. And then I basically, my pitch to Netflix was, I want a show where if you're really in high school and you had the power, you were going to be a vampire, you had cravings for blood, but you didn't know it yet, but you could hypnotize anyone. When the hot cheerleader went to the bathroom, you'd go follow her and hypnotize her and go down on her. And they were like, great, can you come up with anything sicker? So like we did that. And then for season 2, they're like, we love that, like that scene in the bathroom, the transformation, we want that. So I was like, okay, well, what if we do this? And they were super, like they pushed us to just come up with weirder. They're like, we want a show that looks like where people go, there's nothing else like this. And now we're in this great golden age of horror television. I feel like horror TV now is where movies were in 2003 when we had that great year, started with House of Thousand Corpses, 28 Days Later, Cabin Fever, Freddy vs. Jason, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Dawn of the Dead. It was like an amazing renaissance. Mm-hmm. The Descent, High Tension. But there's so many great shows on now, but Netflix has been, it's like the show just went on live at 12:01 a.m. on Friday, and 9 hours later, there were people that had watched every single episode. I'm like, when's season three?
So great. I know, and then that's the only problem is that when you binge watch, then you're like, God, I gotta fucking wait another year. Like, well, that's what happens when you eat it all at once. Binge. You know, like,
but it is like a Papa John's pizza that shows up. You're not thinking like, oh, what's the, like, you're just like, oh, hot pizza. Like, yeah. It just shows you, like, all the slices, tasty pizza. Me want another. Three more. And you're like, well, it's right there. Next thing you're like, exactly. You're like seven episodes in going, oh, I've
But
diarrhea.
It is like, you know, like cable and Netflix have really, seems like they've become the kind of new, not indie film, but just that they, and I think maybe technology helped a lot and effects.
For sure. Because but now you can stream it in 4K. Like, that's the next wave. It's like, they want us to shoot our shows now in 4K. Like, in crazy high definition, people's home theaters look like movies. Like, you can actually have a very high quality cinematic looking show that's not like it's almost like the medium of film and television. They haven't completely merged, but we have this great in between of, you know, networks like this that can do these these amazing shows with the cinematic.
You need a guy like Nicotero who
the best
can do an effect that you can shoot close up.
Yep.
Instead of, you know, like, yeah, the zombies will be over
really
there,
far away.
Just kind of stumble, like that we have the ability, and we have people who understand how to mix practical and digital effects.
Yeah, this guy Todd Masters came in for season 2. He was we came in on season 1, and they got, Greg was directing Walking Dead, and they got busy on other shows. And this guy Todd Masters came in and really just wanted to outdo. Everybody's goal was to outdo everything we did on season 1. Seems to have worked. Like, one scene, he has the Bill Skarsgård biting into someone's neck, and I just watching this fire hydrant of blood shoot out of this girl's neck. It's a hallucination sequence. So he just was like, it wasn't ending. It was like more blood than I spilled in both Hostel movies. Like freaking sets filling up with blood. But it was fun. It was great that Netflix was totally like, people have been asking me really since Hostel to do horror TV, and I just had no interest in it because I thought, well, all the good stuff's going to get taken out. And now they just want you to throw in more. It's fun.
It's so great. It's the idea of, I keep that idea of like, oh, well, let's just make, I mean, Cabin Fever was made for like 1.5 or something like that. It was like, and it made a shit ton of money. Like, why don't more people, and when we were acquired by Legendary, I'm like, why don't we just try to make like cool, $2 million films? And then it seems like, well, the business of it is a lot more complicated than that. Because then you have to market it, and then you like what starts out as seemingly a $2 million film is actually like a $10 or $15 million film once you actually do all the stuff. Is it still, do you agree with that, or do you think, no, you can make a bunch of inexpensive movies and maybe one of them will pop?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look at, The Purge, with the sequels coming out, the first Purge was a $3 million movie, and it opened at $34 million. And I think that Jason Blum has done a really good job. All those Paranormal Activities, they don't do them for more than $3 or $4 million. And
those aren't documentaries? I thought they just found all that footage.
They found everything. I know. Well, that's how much they paid for the footage.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
how much they found the ghost. A camera
they paid Toby
at a yard
to not
sale. And that's all it was.
Bobcat Goldthwait always wanted to do a short on the guy that finds the footage and says, like, it's like, this is so crazy. I better edit this together and then present it to the public.
Well, is there anything else you want to promote?
We got Green Inferno, my cannibal movie, September 5th, coming out from Open Road Films, which I'm
very
excited
about. You're a busy man, Eli Roth.
Yeah, it's really fun. And we created a video game. Nobody knows this. It's top secret. And it's going to go on July 20th on the Apple Store. It's called The Green Inferno. It's an iPad, iPhone, Android, all format game. Nice. Called The Green Inferno Survive. It's totally nuts. It's really fun. It's done. It's a Green Inferno video game because I thought, why not?
I really enjoyed The Last Exorcism.
Oh, thank you.
It was so good.
That was fun. It was a great, great project to be part of. Yeah. Daniel Sam, the director, did an awesome job.
Yeah, that main guy too. The guy
Patrick Fabian.
It was
amazing performance from him. Yeah, it was cool. And Ashley Bell got Spirit nomination. It was great. It was great how that movie broke through. And even though I knew the ending would divide people and people are either going to love it or hate it, it kind of, people looked at it like, it was really nice to see the actors get recognized and directing recognized. Because that was another movie we did for, like $1.6 million. And just totally shot. I mean, they were in this farmhouse making this crazy movie about
themselves. What's your favorite part of it? What's your favorite part of the process?
I don't know. I hate writing. But if I don't write it, I hate it even more. Shooting the movie is the most fun. It's like this crazy adrenaline rush. But do you know what I love more than anything is the sound mix. The sound mix is when you finally, the whole thing that you've done, all whatever bullshit the actors put you through, all the problems you had in editing, where you're like, fuck, this is never going to work. This doesn't make any sense. What did I do? I fucked this up. It's all going to fall apart. Like, you've gotten through all of that. And once the sound effects and the dialogue's there, it finally sounds like a real movie. It doesn't sound like some rough student project. And when the score is there and you're on the mixing station, they just start to blend it together for the first time. It's like you just breathe this fucking sigh of relief going, oh my God, this was worth it. And it's going to work. It's going to work. And even when then they can start to play some finished picture and you're just like, yeah, like I can't wait for an audience to see this. Like, and then people go, wow, the movie's so much better now. And you're like, this is what I had the whole time. Like, this is what it was supposed to be. Like, you're sitting there in the sound mix. There's nothing you can do. You can just, like, check your email. You're on Twitter. You're like, hey.
Nice dark room.
And the mixers are just, like, focusing. And I'm a very, like, detail-oriented person. Like, I love all the details and the sound effects. I'm like, okay, give me that cricket and that blood crunch. And I want to hear if you take a baseball bat on a dead chicken, it's a really good wet punch sound. And broccoli snap mixed with that is, like, a good crunch. I know all the gore sounds that I want. It's really... I was like, okay, I know for their leg shaving, I want like a shovel scraping sideways on a sheet of black ice or like in a driveway, like horrible. You can give them a frame of reference.
You're trying to stump them?
Yeah, well, I try to inspire them. Like the sound people, like they had 17 different chainsaws before we get the right one on Hostel.
It's a North Alaskan reindeer hoof dragging across a box of jujubes.
They love it. The sound people are so into it. When you give them like very, very, very specific direction and sound references, they're like, yeah, we, because they want to come up with new sounds too. You know, they've done, they're used to directors going, yeah, just fill it in. So when you have someone that like wants to get really creative with sound, like you can in horror, like in Green Inferno, like biting the flesh and crunching the bones.
Oh,
and
great.
I mean, it was great. And that movie was insane. We shot that. That's a movie we shot in the Amazon in a village with people that had never, they'd no, there's no electricity, no running water. They're so cut off from civilization. It took 5 hours of travel to get to and from the village every day that it was literally where Werner Herzog had shot A Gear of the Wrath of God. We went like about half an hour farther, just so I could say I went beyond Herzog. And the village, and I was like, can we, I found this village just getting on a boat and going up the Amazon.
Did you hold up your iPad and go, I am your God?
Well, we went and we said, can we shoot here? And they said, well, first we're going to have to explain to them what a movie is. And so the producers went back with a generator and a television, and they showed the whole village Cannibal Holocaust. And so they were like, great news, we got the village. I was like, what? They're like, yeah, we showed them Cannibal Holocaust. I was like, wait, what are you talking? I was like, I thought you guys were going to start with like Wizard of Oz or Star Wars or E.T. They're like, nope, Cannibal Holocaust. The whole village thought it was a comedy. They thought it was hilarious. They'd never, these are five-year-old children that have never experienced a television before, are watching like dicks being sliced off, and they thought it was, they thought it was hilarious. So if you go to the five-year-old kid in this village in Peru and you say, tell me, explain to me what a movie is, they're like, oh, that's where you pretend to eat other people. And they all, everyone in the village signed up to be in the movie. They're like, this sounds like fun. So we went there with video cameras, and like we did like rehearsals to see who could take direction. And I had ADs that went in, and like the half of the village spoke Quechua and half the village spoke Spanish. And so we would speak to them in Spanish and Quechua and kind of weed it out. Like that, we cast all of them as the actors in the movie. They worked building the sets, like helping, like they loved it. Everyone got so into it. We did costumes for all of them. We made up everybody. And like our production designer, Marici, went there like 3 weeks early, and she kind of like took away any sort of modern looking architecture or wood and built the cage where the Americans are going to get taken. These students, protesters that are trying to save the Amazon, get taken to this village by the people they save who think they're the invaders. And this production designer had such a great experience, but she had to go back to Santiago, Chile to finish the rest of the sets. And the village came out and they're like, we have a gift for you. And she's like, what? And they handed her a 3-year-old boy.
No.
Oh, and she's shit. Like, I'm
not
like,
even wrapped.
Not even wrapped. And she's like, a little bow in his hand. They're like, what is this? They're like, it's our gift to you. And she's like, I like live with my boyfriend. I'm like 32. I don't know. Why can't the boy live here? They're like, no, we want to give you something. And she had to decline a baby without offending the village.
How do you do that?
I don't know. She somehow managed to be like, I don't know, but you'll always be my son. I'll come back and visit. You know, you have to give some sort of very tactful. You don't want to let the kid, you know, let the kid down.
You know that. You know what you do in that situation? Regift.
Yeah. Regift. By the way, if Amos,
but I got you.
But look what Eli. Look who we got you for the movie.
Sure.
Here's a rap gift. But it was amazing. You know, because the whole village, like, we have this opening sequence. I really wanted to look like Apocalypse Now. Like you're arriving in Colonel Kurtz's village. These American students, their plane crashes on their way home, and they're darted, and they wake up, and they're tied up in these wooden canoes, and they're like, you know, trees that have been carved out, and they're supposed to look like Uncontacted Man. Like, and we took the look straight out of National Geographic from Venezuela, Brazil, Peru, like real tribal looks from the 60s and 70s, and kind of created our own tribe. But so all the natives are painted and the Mo Howard haircuts and everything. And like, we got K&B is down there with us. Took us forever to get the body parts through Peruvian customs, because apparently we're the first horror movie that shot there. And apparently getting shipping body parts is an actual issue in Peru.
Oh,
so we had to like convince them they were fake. Like, we're the first movie that did this. So we're farther than cameras have gone. We get the body parts up there and like heads on pikes and dead bodies, and all the Americans are in canoes, and like hundreds of villagers with the spears and the knives. And just as we're about to start shooting, it's like our first day, the first scene. I've like built up everything. I got this great sequence, and these like two pontoon boats pull up, and people start like playing music and songs about Jesus. I was like, what the fuck's going on? And they're like, it was missionaries from a super church in Texas. Christian missionaries showed up in the village to convert the village to Christianity. And we're like, what the fuck's going on? And they're like, and they see the heads on the spikes and the dead bodies and the students tied up and the people painted red. And they're like, the devil is here. Like, this is it. Like, we found the mouth of hell. And I was like, of course, running to grab my camera to film this for behind the scenes because it's way more interesting than anything. And they were like, the Peruvians had told me back, like, no, like, this is a serious issue. Like, we got to let the village handle this. So the village had to go out and tell them to fuck off. Like, whoa. Basically, like, Eli Roth is here shooting a movie. And they were like, what? Like, the Texans knew I was. They were so angry that we had beat them to the punch. And they were like, sorry, guys, come back in 3 weeks. It was amazing.
You can convert later.
Yeah. They did. No, and so the people, the missionaries, go out, like, outside of the shot, like, in the middle of the river, and just start blasting their music. Because they're like, we're going to disrupt your shooting. But thank God it was, you know, 115 degrees in the blazing sun.
So
and the
they
current,
died.
Current took them, yeah.
Oh, no.
They got eaten. Good. We had them for lunch.
It's good to see you, and I really...
Good to see you,
please
Chris.
Please come back on. Please, please, please come back on.
I'd love to. I got a lot more stories about Inferno. Plenty more.
Have you ever thought about doing a podcast? It feels like...
It's fun. I like it. I have this app called The Crypt, which is like horror people making shorts and doing things.
Yeah, I use it.
It's cool. It's really great. Like, people post stuff. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So if you're like a horror fan, you have short form stuff. It's really cool. But I thought about doing a podcast. It's just, I've just been kind of busy. But I love it. I love talking and telling stories. But you're, you know, I'll come back here anytime. It's my pleasure.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. The end. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.